This is the Saturday Night Live birthday meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous held at Westgate West in San Jose, California on April the 29th, 2000. Our speaker is John C. of Los Gatos, California. The original recording of this meeting is kept in the SNL Tape Library. Please observe the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous and do not play this recording for commercial or entertainment purposes. Please do not break the anonymity of the speakers at any other AA member at the public level. Thank you.
My name is John. I'm an alcoholic. You know, if you have been a member of Saturday Night Live and you're still here this evening, you're a lot sicker than I thought, I'll tell you that. I'm glad to see that we have a visitor, that my speaking this evening is so important that they came all the way from Portland, Oregon. It's probably the first time he's had any sobriety in and around him in probably 5 or 6 years. So I guess I better be pretty good, so he's going to have to take it away to last him the next 10 years. I introduced myself as an alcoholic, and that is a piece of information I got when I got here. I had no knowledge of the disease of alcoholism, and I am so unbelievably grateful for the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a debt that I have been paying on for, and I will continue to pay on for the rest of my life. It's a debt that enabled me to have everything that is of any importance and any value in my life today. And the reason I put it that way is, unfortunately, I only have one story, and for those of you who heard it, the only thing you're going to get is a little twist, maybe, if you're lucky. But I'll be damned if I'm going to go out and get new information. The reason it's so important for me is constantly to remind myself of the power of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the absolute power that are in the rooms of AA. They can take tongue-chewing, babbling idiot drunks just basically off the street and instill in them a charge that is that they are capable of transmitting. And the reason I say that is just simply this, and you've heard the story. There was a young man who kept hanging around me, and I thought I had effectively gotten rid of every miserable son of a bitch that hang around me, because I did not like people. And he was hanging around me, and I loaned him some money to buy a car. And he came by my office one afternoon, and I loaned him the money to buy a car because he was getting a divorce and all of his money was tied up. And so he came by and he said the divorce was over, he was going to pay me back, and he had been drinking. He said, "Let's go out and celebrate." So I went out and celebrated with him. And that miserable dude did not know how to carry his booze very well, and my daughter woke me up around 3 o'clock in the morning to bail him out, because he got drunk and he hit a fence and he got arrested and all that crap for people who do not know how to carry their booze. Fortunately, I've always been able to do that. And there's a particular twist that is always so fascinating to me, because my time had come, and I can only tell you that because my time had come. I got a couple of books because at that time the only thing I had to entertain myself was alcohol and books. Because the family didn't want to talk to me. And so I grabbed a couple of books. And one of the books I brought was Reader's Digest Condensed Stories, the 1976 edition, March. And I ran out of things to read, because in that book there was a story about a man named Bill W. And I wasn't going to read that damn book about a drunk when I'm waiting for a drunk who does not know how to carry his liquor. So anyway, I bailed him out, and the next thing I know, I'm sitting in a saloon, and it's on a Thursday night. And this same young man suddenly appeared. It's somewhere around 10:30 or 11 o'clock. I'm drinking some bourbon whiskey, and he had been to the guerrilla meeting. Most of you know where the guerrilla meeting is. And he had been so charged up by what happened in that meeting with his 5 hot days of sobriety. 5 days of sobriety. Good God, you haven't even stopped smelling in 5 days. This crazy dude come in and sat down beside me and ordered a Coke, which has got to tell you how nuts he was. I'm in a saloon and he's drinking Cokes. And he told me about you and he told me I would like you, and I knew he was insane. And he said to me, he said, "Would you like to go to an AA meeting?" And much to my absolute amazement and disgust, I said yes. And a miracle happened that day, or that time. And the only reason I call it a miracle, if you want to define a miracle, is a break in the logical sequence of events. Because the compulsion to drink was lifted from me, I slid back that fourth drink, and I have not had one from that moment to this. And that's the power of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And for those of you who have not experienced the power of the program, I feel sorry for you. Because I think you're shielding yourself from the power that is in these rooms, the magnificent, unbelievable power of Alcoholics Anonymous, of a loving God manifesting himself through the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, my sponsor is a great one for talking about the power of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he says that this power of God was so disgusted with these drunks. He says, "You guys have been before the doctors and you've been before the psychiatrists. You've been before my healers and the religious people. And there's nothing you can do about it, so I'm going to sick you on each other." And it's pretty damned effective, because ever since he made that decision to sick us on each other, we have grown alarmingly such. And I told you when I got here, when I started this thing, that everything that is near and dear to me, that is of any value to me, was given to me as a direct result of coming here. I came in here and the status of my being was sucked. I was married to a lady that was unkind. She had a little palace in I call it the ice palace, and it was called a bedroom. Sometimes I went in there and shaved. I had a bunch of kids. They had turned up and all rotten. They had dreadful kids. They all ran away from home, except one who was too little to run away. And, you know, I could talk about that, and we can laugh about that, but, you know, it was so sad, because I really loved my wife. And it's so sad, I adored my children. And all I wanted, and all I've ever really wanted to be in my entire life, I just wanted to be a good father. I wanted to make a couple of bucks. I never had any great dreams of being rich and famous or anything like that. I just wanted to do a good job, a journeyman type person, have some fun, raise some kids, stay with a lady that I married. And it didn't happen that way, because I have been blessed or cursed, whichever way you look at it, with a disease called alcoholism. I didn't know I had it. Seems to have a genetic run through my family, because I'm the only carny, and that's my last name. I'm the only carny male that has lived past the age of 55 in 7 generations of my clan. So that gives you a clue that the carnies die young. Not this one. I'm an old bastard, I'll tell you. You know, for those of you who are looking forward to hearing the speaker from Escondido, the description of this was, he's a real old nut who is kind of very involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he rides a motorcycle. Well, I'm substituting for that crazy bastard. And if there's any similarity between he and I, it's purely coincidental, because I'm a much, much more dignified person. I don't ride a Harley. I rode a Goldwing. You know, one of the things that happened to me when in sobriety is that through the process of working this 12 steps of recovery, I don't know about you. Can tell you about me. That all my life I've said, my life has been just a story of, "Oh God, why didn't I?" "No, Jesus, I wished I had it, and I should have done, and if only." That seemed to be the story of my life, and when I got sober, I found out that you gave me the tools. I don't have to live that way anymore. And the reason I'm going to tell this little bit about one day I was born a long time ago. But I spent some time down in the Imperial Valley before water was down there on a homestead. Came from poor stock. We were poor by virtue of the fact we had little money, but who did have any money in the Depression? And I have a great affinity and a love for the desert country. And I was home watching television, and I'd see these desert scenes, and I'd get so, "Oh!" And my wife would say, God, why don't we go into the desert? And I said, no, that's all right. And one day I cried and moaned, and she said, why don't you go into the desert by yourself? And so I got in my car and took off for a couple of weeks, and I had a fabulous retreat. But I was riding down this very, very dirt road out in the middle of nowhere, communicating with the God of my understanding. And I saw a cactus, and on the cactus was an eagle. And it really got to me. And I stopped the car, and I wanted to drink in the beauty of this majestic bird. And I know eagles are not supposed to sit on cactus. And I decided I was going to take a picture of it, so I opened up the door, and the eagle flew away. There was a voice that came into my head and said, that wouldn't have happened if you'd had a motorcycle. Now, that's the most insane thought I've ever had in my entire life, because I have been a great believer, and I've stood at this podium or podium similar in Saturday Night Live for many years and said, assholes, idiots, and egg suckers ride motorcycles. I still think that's probably true. But I have to tell you, old people do not learn how to ride motorcycles very easily. And I've got a few broken bones and scars to prove that. But I've had my retreats to I've had my retreats in the desert on my motorcycle. It's the most awesome experience I've ever had. And I started this is because I was not going to say, well, I am too old to learn how to ride a motorcycle. I was sitting in the hospital recovering from open heart surgery, reading the test report on how to take a test to ride a motorcycle. So at the tender age of 65, I started riding motorcycles. It's one of the greatest experiences I've ever had. And I would have never had that if I had not come here. If my mouth had not said yes when I meant really no. I wasn't a good drunk. Some people tell some of the most magnificent stories I've ever heard from the podium of Alcoholics Anonymous. They tell just fabulous stories. And I get this, just goodness, God, how much fun they had. And I say, sometimes I get so overwhelmed with their beauty of their stories, I wonder what the hell they're doing so sober, because they're so funny. But I haven't got any funny stories. I got stupid stories. Just stupid stories. You know, those out of absolute total ignorance. Alcohol took me places I didn't want to go and made me do things I didn't want to do. And one of the stories, I've got a couple of stories that I tell, and only just to exaggerate, not to exaggerate, but demonstrate the absolute stupidity of my drinking. Is all I really wanted to ever be was a good guy. I failed. I just wanted to be a good husband. But you see, the tantalizing lure of alcohol just didn't let me go home. I lived in Southern California for quite a while, and once I took a drink in a little town called Rivera that is no longer there. It's called Pico Rivera. It's out near a little town called Whittier that's made famous by Richard Nixon, who was born in Whittier, California. They've aired the town out since, so. I took a drink in that town, and I came to, now I'm not a bad guy, and I've never pretended to be a bad guy. Now I've done plenty of bad things, but I've never pretended to be a bad guy. I took a drink in a little town called Rivera, and I came to in a little town called Watts. And I was looking down the barrel of a .38 revolver, held by a policeman who wanted. I got the distinct impression when he said "freeze" that I should stop breathing, which I did for an hour or two. And I got thrown in jail for armed robbery. Now the story is not the drunk. The story is the absolute insanity of the alcoholic. I was wearing one of the most gorgeous suits God has ever allowed a man to wear. My dream suit, one I had wanted all of my life. It was a double-breasted, tan, gabardine suit. And I looked absolutely gorgeous in that thing. I was just the prettiest sucker you would ever want to know. And there I am in Watts in my double-breasted, tan, gabardine suit and tie. And I really didn't belong in Watts. And they threw me in jail. Now, I've lost a little bit of time here because I don't really know what happened. But after a day or two or three of sleeping in that pigsty and being rousted around a little bit, I had a lineup in which I was standing there in this lineup because they were going, apparently I was in for armed robbery or a suspicion of armed robbery. And this is long before Miranda, believe me. For those of you who had made it into the jails before that, they're not nice. And they don't have to be nice. They're brutal. I had two broken ribs on that particular adventure. But as I stood up there in that lineup for them to determine whether I had shot up that liquor store, because somebody had, in a tan gabardine suit. The interesting thing was, in that lineup, I was the only white man. Now, it's a pretty sad situation when you don't know if you are the guy behind the gun. Now, I didn't own a gun. I know how to shoot one. I held several marksman's medals in the Army, but I'm not a weapon carrier. I don't believe in it. But I didn't know. And anyway, long and the short of it is they let me out. They never told me. They just said I was not identified, and they let me out, and I came home. And you know what my problem was? That damn gabardine suit. I never wore it since. You see, if I hadn't have been drinking, if I had not been wearing that gabardine suit, they would have never thrown me in the jail. That's the thinking of an alcoholic. You know, it's the same thing when I got a couple more broken ribs one night when I was following a little bit too close behind somebody on a freeway down near Long Beach. And they pulled me over. And they threw me in jail. And they had difficulty printing because I got scars on my hands, quite a bit of scars on my hands. I don't print very well, the thumbprint and the like. So they get very upset when you don't give a nice clean print. So you get to do it again. And if you start to talk, they hit you and that sort of stuff. You know, and I've been up, so I wasn't until I was a year sober in Alcoholics Anonymous that I would concede the fact that I got arrested for drunk driving. And I didn't get arrested for drunk driving. I got arrested for driving too close. They didn't know I was drinking when they pulled me over. They found out afterwards. This is the logic of an alcoholic. I was unjustly accused and falsely sentenced. Damn policemen are out to get you. There's a great plot, and the plot is out to get me. It's the story of my life, and that's my alcoholism. You know, I'm the story of that stupid guy called the jaywalker. Can you believe that is the absolute stupidest story in the whole big book of Alcoholics Anonymous? Nobody could be that stupid. I was that stupid for 30 years. I like to impress myself with my brilliance and say this, that when I drank my first drink out of the Green Frog in El Paso, Texas, not that I remember, in 1946, oh God, 1946, I had my first drink. I was 18 years old, and I got drunk, and I went places I should not have gone to, and I did things they told me about, and I had a wonderful time. And like I like to tell you and remind me that I had everything I needed to know about the disease of alcoholism my first time out. And I spent 30 years gathering more useless information. I just don't know what's best for me. I found out an awful lot about me since I've got here. I found out that I am, in true fact, a child of a loving Creator, and I didn't know that. You see, I found out a lot of things about me, and I'll tell you about some of the stuff that I found about me. As one of them, I took myself a little bit seriously. I don't know if you did or not, but I was a very important person when I got here. I had scowl marks that were permanently etched in my forehead. Now this is just wrinkles because I'm old. I learned how to laugh in Alcoholics Anonymous. I learned how to take myself not so damn seriously. What a frightening concept that is if you are one of, like me, who come in here and the whole goddamn world hinges around your decisions. Because you're pretty important, and all of your decisions have been wrong, but you have to recognize that when you come here, they offer a little solution called don't take yourself too damn seriously. And I think one of the greatest joys there is in Alcoholics Anonymous is to watch a newcomer who, after a period of time, their face cracks and they laugh. And it's just like this. They're sitting there, and they're all frowning, and suddenly someone will be sitting there, that don't want anybody to know they're laughing, because it's pretty goddamn serious. Well, I found out I could laugh in Alcoholics Anonymous for reasons yet obscure to me, that I was touched, and I was touched very hard. And I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and there were a bunch of bastards in that room, and they talked sick, and they said bad things, and they insulted me, and I didn't like them a lot. But somebody by the name of Johnny O'Boy, not that I would break his anonymity, he inferred that I didn't have enough guts to stay sober for 90 days, and I'd say, "I'll see you, sucker." I got mad enough to go to my second meeting, and the quality of the people were much better in the second meeting than the first meeting. And I decided to go back to the back to that same meeting and called St. Luke's, and they had changed a great deal in a week, and they were much nicer. And I can tell you only this, is I totally and absolutely fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous on my second week of sobriety, on my fourth meeting. Absolutely. And I've been rocketed ever since. I've been given so much goodies. I started reading the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. There are certain things that I had to do. I see, you people have to do what you have to do, and I had to do what I had to do. I had to learn how to join Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I found out through a God of intervention of a God of my understanding that you become a member of Alcoholics Anonymous when you say you are, but I didn't believe that. So I had to learn how to do things. One of the things I had to do is I had to become, I don't know how to mix. I still don't mix very well. But one of the ways you mix in Alcoholics Anonymous is become visible. Did you know you can hide in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous? Every once in a while, somebody will surface, and they will introduce themselves to you and say, "You don't know me, but I've been in the room for 7 years, and I've never seen him before in my life," or something like that. But you can hide in here. And I wasn't about to be hidden in Alcoholics Anonymous. So In those days, I volunteered to read. I was reading every damn meeting until they finally get sick and tired of me. Purpose of reading was not that I needed attention. It's the fact that you would know my name, and therefore you would say hi to me. Do something like that if you'd be new. Get involved. I didn't know how involved I was getting, but I became known, and people knew my name, and I started to know their name. I shook hands and washed ashtrays. We don't have ashtrays, but I sure shook hands. Damn it. Ooh, touching other people is disgusting. Absolutely disgusting. Ooh! It was just dreadful, the things I had to do at the very beginning. But I started reading the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous because it says if you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, then we are ready to take certain steps. And since I did not know what any lengths was, I started reading the book to find out. Because I know this, by God, with my pride and arrogance, if I got a sponsor, I'm going to damn well know how to take the steps, and I'm going to damn well prove to him that I'm willing to go to any lengths. And so that's what I did. And one of the first things I had to do is learn how to share. Yeah, you learn how to share. Damn right you have to learn how to share. It's a fellowship of men and women who share. You want to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous? Learn how to share. How do you learn how to share? I went home one night, and when I found out that I had to learn how to share, I walked home and told my wife, I said, "Peggy, I'm going to share." And she looked at me like I was a little crazy, and I wasn't. I was going to share. And she said, "What do you mean?" And I said, "I'm going to speak on a subject that is really important to me. I'm going to be as open and honest as I know how to be, and your job is to sit and listen. Try to understand. Don't interrupt. And when I'm done, you can speak on the same topic if you choose, or a topic of your choice. And you will be as honest and open as you can, and I will sit and listen, try to understand, not interrupt. And you want you to know these damn Al-Anons know how to share. They're disgusting." And it starts this way, if you be new. Brace yourself, because you're going to learn how to share. It says a much more important demonstration of these principles lies at home. At home. That is too stupid. I went home with it. Thank God I hadn't heard these people around Alcoholics Anonymous say, "Oh, it's so tough at home." Hell, it's tough doing anything you don't want to do. So you go home. I told her, you know, and she started sharing. And the sharing in Alcoholics Anonymous, if you're married to an Al-Anon, if you're married, you're married to an Al-Anon. I don't give a damn what they're for. Boy, they just grow fangs and do all sorts of stuff. An Al-Anon says this. They say this when they're sharing. They say, "Do you remember when?" "Oh, God, I don't want to remember when." And that's a, she'd tell me when and remember, and I wouldn't want to hear it, and I'd run to an AA meeting and whine and snivel and cry. And the reason I couldn't tell her about how devastating this was, and she shouldn't talk to me that way because I'm far too much too important, is the book said, damn it, it says we had to avoid retaliation. I have to avoid retaliation. And then it says also fault-finding needed to be avoided like the plague. You're screwed when you start sharing. If you believe in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I started doing that. Amazing things started to happen. Most amazing things happened. I didn't know what the hell was happening. I remember coming home when I was a couple months sober. Just coming home, just minding my own damn business, and suddenly I'm infused with this god-awful feeling. I don't know what the hell's wrong with this feeling. Crazy feeling. I didn't know. And I came up to Peg and I said, I got a feeling. And she said, what is it? I said, I don't know. Never had one like it before. She says, what is it, good or bad? And I said, I think it's good. And she said, what's wrong with that? And I said, I got no reason to feel good. All my life I've known full well the only reason you're ever going to feel good is because you got a reason to feel good. And she said, well, if it feels good, if you're going to call it something, what are you going to call it? And I thought about it for a brief half second and said, it's called impending good. I have a disease called impending good. I now found out in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, you can feel good just because you're breathing. You can feel good just because you're sober. You can feel good just because. You can feel good because it's the natural state of man. I believe that in all my heart and soul right now. I didn't know it then. So I got a case of impending good. And I love it. It was given to me. It was a gift, a part of the great gift of Alcoholics Anonymous. I walk up to my wife because all hell's breaking loose in my life. And I'm so noticing the house has changed just a little bit. The children are calling me, talking to me. They haven't talked to me in years. Didn't want to talk to me. They talked to me because I suffer from the black cord disease. Did anybody have a black cord disease? You drink, and then you're suddenly concerned that everybody's going to die. So you pick up the telephone to find out if they're alive. Then you find out they're alive, you give the phone to your wife. You don't give a damn about them. You just had a feeling you wanted to. That's what I call a black cord disease. I checked on everybody that I knew in the entire world every time I got drunk. Telephone was just, you could chart every drunk I had by the telephone bill. If I remember to call them. That's the way it was. As a matter of fact, my sister-in-law, who I love dearly, said, boy, I love you, John. I love you very much, but I'm sure sorry in a way that you're sober because I never get a chance to talk to Peggy anymore. Stupid. Stupid drunk. And when you stand back and look at your disease and look at the places you went and the things you did, in light of the sobriety that has been given to you, it is absolutely inconceivable that we could deluded ourselves for the time that we deluded ourselves, believing that I'm not hurting anybody but myself. I walked up to my wife in a few months of sobriety and I told her and I said, Peggy, something's happening here and I'm concerned. I'm really afraid. And she said, what are you afraid of? I said, I'm changing and I'm changing a great deal. I don't know what to do about it, but I'm not going to change because I'm going with this thing. She said, why does that bother you? And I said, well, our relationship seems to be working now and I don't know why, but I don't want to louse it up. And she said, don't worry about that. You're growing into becoming the man I always knew you were. I don't know how Al-Anons know that. I really don't know that. Al-Anons have a thing called P. The P word. Potential. Did you know I had a fabulous potential? You might need to know that. Because I found out I got a potential. I don't know how big the potential is, but by God, I got the P word. So look up and you can say, by God, there's a man of real potential. That's my name. I've had the best of everything as a direct result of coming here in the process of working the 12 steps of recovery. The first thing that this is stupid. It's inconceivable. You know, when you're really serious, things happen that are really important, just dreadfully important. And when you're managing your own life, or you're trying to manage your own life, and you get caught up in this powerless crap, powerless, oh, what a sucking powerless. Ah, I want to just grab and tear the world apart, but they told me I was powerless, and I got to thinking about that. One of the first things I found out, powerless. You ever try to make somebody love you? Now, I have... for years before I got sober. Now, this is powerless and not knowing it. And as far as I'm concerned, when people tell them a powerless story, they're going to say something stupid. really dumb. But oh, at the time, it's the most painful thing in the world. Now, I used to shave in front of a mirror in my bedroom, and I still do that now because I still have hair on my face. And on the side of the sink, there is a shelf that has no doors on it where I keep my shaving lotion. Now, shaving lotion, for some reason, I do not have any clue whatsoever, is vitally important to me. It is absolutely important. Now, I'm a working man, and I got big things to do and places to go, and so my wife takes care of all the shopping. It's beneath my dignity to do anything like that, or it used to be before I became a wimp. And so I would shave, and I look at the shaving lotion, and I would notice, by God, it's getting a little low. And then I'd look behind. I have a pair of sliding glass mirrors right behind me in a wardrobe, and I'd peek in there and look and find out if she's got a spare bottle of shaving lotion there. Because, you see, if she loved me, she'd have a bottle there just to make sure I didn't run out. And I'd look up there, and I said, God, she ought to do something about that. A couple of days later, I look at that damn shaving lotion getting lower and lower. And I look back there, and that bitch hasn't bought anything. Now, God damn it, if that woman loved me, she would buy me some shaving lotion. Now, you are laughing at this, and this is vitally serious. And pretty soon, that witch hasn't bought anything. I'm starting to ration my own goddamn shaving lotion. Yeah! Then finally, at the last minute, she buys it, and I say, good God, she really doesn't love me. Every once in a while, she'd buy two. Then I'd say, oh, for Christ's sake, now she doesn't have to worry about me for a year. It is my considered opinion that everybody in this room has a shaving lotion story of their own. But I'll tell you, when you're going through it, isn't the pain and the agony. Damn it, it's got to be important. If it's important to me, it's got to be important to me. I walk up to my wife, I get sober, and I tell her the shaving lotion story. All these Al-Anon are vicious, I'll tell you. I walk up and I told her about it, and she looked at me, and she has this stupid look on her face, and she said, well, why didn't you tell me? And come right out of my mouth, the perfect answer, well, if I told you, it didn't count. You see, you're supposed to know this. If you loved me, you would know this. Because I broadcast these things so strongly. There's a need inside of me for fulfillment. Isn't that wonderful? I hope you're properly impressed by the magnitude of my knowledge and the things that I have done and how much knowledge I have acquired. I took the second step, and in the process of second step, I realized that I truly understood for the first time that my thinking was crooked, because I started at that time to become aware of some of the stupid stories I'm telling you now. And I'm not a romantic guy, or romantic in the sense, romanticize the things and try to glamorize them. When I first got here, I didn't have any drunk logs. I couldn't have told you that Gabardine suit story, because I didn't know it. I couldn't have told you that. As a matter of fact, it was about 5 years ago, I was speaking at a podium someplace with my lovely bride, and I told a story that now I really like it, because everybody knows how stupid it is, because I'm hoping that somewhere along the line I'm going to get an answer to the story. And so I'll have to inflict upon you the story again. This is where I started to realize how, in the second step, the unmanageability of my own life and the fact that my life was absolutely unmanageable by me, and it never will be by me, because there's nowhere in the book that will tell me, by me, my life is going to be manageable. Okay? And this power is going to have to enter into my life and restore me to some sort of semblance of sanity or rational thinking. I was standing and I was speaking at the podium, and suddenly I kind of laughed a little bit and said the story like this was that, you know, alcoholism took me places I didn't want to go and made me do things I didn't want to do. And I took a drink in Fresno. Fresno is a cesspool of the world. If you did not know that, I need to tell you that. They took, that's the place I bottomed out. That's where they took every vestige of dignity and every dollar I had. And I had to go back doing something. In order to put food on my table, I had to go back doing a job that I did when I was 18 years old. And didn't you know I was a big, powerful businessman who had just gone bankrupt? I was unemployable again for, I think, the fifth time in my entire life. My wife announced that she was pregnant. And, you know, that's just a casual statement, but, you know, that's no big deal. Ha! Wow, wife says she's pregnant. Did you know that I had had a vasectomy when we got married? Did you know that she was medically incapable of conceiving? There's a plot out there. And she was pregnant. You know, I talked that over with a number of bartenders in town, and they all seemed to think. They all seemed to think there was something kind of weird going on. Nobody ever had an answer for me. Shows you how virile I am. I've had two vasectomies. What? Oh, not am. Used to be. This is in my youth. But I took a drink in that lousy town called Fresno, and I came to in a shitty town called Chico. That just shows you how bad Fresno is if you got to run to Chico. But my story in Chico is because one day somebody's going to come up and tell me something about that story. And maybe they'll clue me in, and I sure hope it's a woman, I'll tell you that. Because I came to in this lousy $5 a night motel room that was so poor that there wasn't even a shower curtain on it, on the shower. And when I came to and I was feeling lousy, oh God, I was feeling lousy. And now I've been wearing pajamas most of my life, and I can't even go to sleep without putting my jammies on. And so I didn't have any jammies. I didn't have any clothes on at all. And I just don't ever sleep that way. I was alone, and it was a dreadful room. And I staggered into the bathroom, because I was seeing blurred things all over me, and I looked in the mirror, and I saw that I had purple stripes all over my body. They were about an inch and a half long, about a quarter of an inch thick. They were purple. They were and all over my body, and they were in places that I cannot reach, and I can assure you they were in places where somebody else should never reach. Now, this is stupid, because there's no sign of how they came there. And the only thing I can just see coming home, Peg! All over. Would you like to try to explain that? No. The only thing I can tell you about is they washed off. Now, there's no ending to that story until... Because you just left hanging. They washed off. Think, isn't that grand? I don't have to walk around with purple stripes on it for the rest of my life. Hey, do you know what these are? Hell, I even spoke up in Chico one time here a couple of years ago and asked if the person out there would know about it, would talk to me afterwards. Only women need apply, please. See? Isn't it so grand that we can laugh about stupid stories like that, but at the time it was serious? It was so serious I forgot about it, and I didn't remember it until one night I was talking about 14, 15 years later, maybe later. I do not know. Just happened. So this is starting to learn out in a second step, learning to understand just a little bit how my thinking was a little bit twisted. I took my third step, all hell broke loose. I found a God of my very own and realized something in this process, that I chose my own conception of God. And I advise you to do that. And the reason I advise you to do that, if you have not, is because the book advises you to do that. And I did precisely what the book, because it said one of the many things it says in the book, one of it is with this attitude you cannot fail, and that all you have to do is become willing to believe. Even willing to believe, and I was willing to believe. So I started this fabulous journey of recovery by becoming willing to believe. And I started praying to learn how to pray, and I started praying. I did not know it at the time. I just started to practice praying. I had to, one of the conceptions of God of my understanding was that he had to be a forgiving God, all forgiving. I could not deal with a God of punishment. Chamberlain gave me the words, bless his heart, he says, I was born with a pitchfork in my hand. I was condemned to go to hell. That's all there was to it. If there was a God, that's where I was going to go. And if I got to choose a God, I was going to choose a God that would forgive me. And I did. I chose a God that would forgive me. But you see, with that goes a hook. I have to accept that forgiveness. I have to accept that forgiveness. You see, it says in our third step that there is only one God and you can't play it. And if I start playing it, I don't have a God. I'm back in the same goddamn world I was before I got here. So I had to forgive me or accept the forgiveness of God. And what I think of me no longer is my business. It's my Father's business. If there's any judgment, it's not going to be done by me, and I had to give it up. It's the hardest thing I've ever done. But I did it. A miracle happened on that. I took my third step. In case you haven't noticed, I have a tendency for a little grandiosity. Yeah, I do. It's a sad thing to say, but I do. I took my third step with my wife, my daughter, the guy who brought me to my first meeting, and myself. And we went up to the Santa Cruz Mountains and did it out loud. We found that there's no question. When I take a step, and when I have taken a step, there's no question about whether I've taken it or not. I believe in that all the way down. Now, I've reaffirmed these steps many, 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 many times over these years. But when I took my third step, that was it. I reaffirmed, as I say, and try to live to that step. But when I did it, I turned my will and my life over to the care of God. We stood in a circle up there in the Santa Cruz Mountains, and we knelt, and I turned my will and my life over to the care of my God. My daughter Jackie turned her will and life over to the care of her God. My wife turned her will and her life over to the care of her God. My son pulled on his mommy's hand and said, "Mommy, will you do it for me?" So Peggy turned his life over to the God of her understanding, and his will would be his business when he addresses that issue whenever. And he was born with a learning disability that dissolved that night. It came back, but you know, as it came back, it was gone for several years, and in several years I was stone ass broke. I came in with a lot of money, immediately lost it when I got sober. And in that period of time, he was getting special education because of his learning disability. And as soon as we took our third step, my money went and his disability went. And he had a normal schooling until it returned with vengeance. And when it came back, I had money and I put him into a special school. There was about 3 years. And I love the timing of a God of my understanding. He's never on time, but he's never late. He's always there, just exactly at the right time, but always late, as far as I'm concerned. I did a four-step, and in the process of doing a four-step, I became aware of the fact I knew the exact nature of my wrongs, and I found out, now for the very first time, I don't know about you, I know about me. I have spent most of my life rehashing and living over and trying to fix the goddamn wars that are already over with. I've done many, many things I've regretted, and I've fought over them, I've twisted them, I've changed them, I've maneuvered them, I've got even, I've killed, I've done these things over and over and over again until it boils down to, if you be an alcoholic like of my type, you're drinking yourself to sleep every night, or hopefully pass out so you will not have to do the war as it was over with. And because you see, all I do was rehash the events and try to change the events. And when in the process of doing my inventory, I'll be damned if I didn't find out why. Why this thing had to happen. It says these instincts in our 12 and 12, these instincts, powerfully, blindly, sometimes subtly, they drive us and try to dominate our very existence. And I found the exact nature of my wrongs. I slammed my fist on the table that night. Sorry for that, lady, but I hurt my hand then, too, you know. God, I got power, I'll tell you. I scream no more. I'll never have to do that again. And that's the truth. I'll never have to do that again, provided I follow through with the same things that everybody else has, steps 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I'll never have to do that. I'll never have to live that way again. I will never have to do that again. And I ran to my sponsor, that miserable dude. I came in front of him. I was around 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, and I finished up and went and I shaved, and I went and got to work. I never went to bed that day, and I went to his office. He's a real estate agent, and he had his own office in. And I walked into his office and said, "Jack, I'm here to do my fourth step or fifth step." He said, "I'm busy." And I said, "I'm not." He said, "I'm busy for a while." And I said, "Jack, I have nothing to do." So I sat down. Every hour or so, he'd look over and he said, "I'm still busy." And I'd say, I'm still waiting. Yeah. Finally, around 2 o'clock in the afternoon, he looked at me and said, oh, shit, let's go. And I took my deepest, darkest, rotten, filthy secrets into the restaurant. You would think, with this powerful information I have, that I'd get a sealed booth somewhere with armed guards to protect me. But no. The Sherwood Inn, right across from the cashier in a booth. So everybody going in and out of that damn door had a chance to listen to Carney. You know, the surprising thing is nobody stopped. They just didn't really give a darn. That's kind of disappointing when you really got some stuff to vomit out and nobody wants to listen to it. Anyway, that's what happened. And when he was all done, he said, good work. You got it right. Now go home and do exactly what the book said. And I went home and I did exactly what the book said. I carefully reread those first 5 proposals, making sure I had not left out anything. And I meant it with all my heart and soul. And I looked at my sixth step and realized that I was about to ask the God of my understanding to enter in my life in a way that was indeed different than a third step. You see, I was entirely ready, as our book suggests, that entirely ready to have God do this, do His business. Then I looked at my seventh step and realized that I had humility, and one of the definitions of humility is absence of pride. I like to think it also is a true understanding of self, and at that time I had it. Absolutely. So I fell to my knees and there was absolutely nothing. Nothing between me and the God of my understanding, and there was no reservations of any nature. There was no plea bargaining, there was no wheels and deals. This was at that moment, at that absolute second, without any question, I was perfect. I was right on target. Just exactly where I was supposed to be. And I entered into a covenant with the God of my understanding, and it was very simple, and I just simply this, that my God knew everything there was about me that I knew, and I just said that if you tell me when I'm starting to screw up, I'm going to stop. And He's been doing a splendid job on that, and He's doing a much better job on that than I am. But I entered into covenant with Him because I believe in prayer, and I believe in obedience to the prayers that I offered, and I do my best to be obedient to the prayers that I've offered then. And I launched into, I took my inventory, and I took the list of the people whom I had harmed, and I figured out exactly what I did to them, why, and I knew exactly why I did it, because I knew I had a list of my character flaws and defects, and I knew what caused me to do the act, and I don't think making an amends makes any sense whatsoever. You don't know what the hell you did it in the first place. You have to know why you did it. Otherwise, if you don't know why you did it, you're going to do it again. I'm sorry I robbed you, and you go down the street and rob somebody else. Doesn't make sense. So I took it a wonderful thing and said, I believe in that. And then the wonderful thing about this man of Chamberlain that I was my mentor, I believe I call him, he certainly was and is one of my heroes. He talked about making amends to his children, and I made amends to my children. And I made amends to my children just the way he made amends to his children. Now, my children are much older than his were at that time, so they didn't necessarily take it quite as well as his did. But I told them, essentially, there's no longer any father in your house. I've forfeited any and all rights there was to be a father. I drank it away, and for that I am truly sorry, and I regret it with all my being. So you don't have to call me Dad unless you want to. You don't have to do anything I say. All I want to do is love you, and if there's anything I can do that will add to your life, please let me know, and I'll try to do it. But you don't have to obey me. You just all have to do all I'm going to do. And the only thing I have that is of any value to you, in my opinion, is the love that I feel for you. Now, they didn't understand it and they didn't like it. Some of them really reamed me out rather badly. One of them ran away for almost 10 years and wouldn't talk to me. Just a little while ago, I love this story because it's so goddamn sweet. It's just part of the magnificent beauty of Alcoholics Anonymous. One of my girls who was tolerated me. She would give me hugs, but you could tell there was a great wall that existed between she and I, but she was very, very close to her mother. One night she came running over to our house and she was just sobbing her little heart out, and Peggy got up, jumped up, started running into the garage so Vicky would go with her. And Vicky said, no, Mom, I'm here to talk to Daddy. And she threw her arms around me. And I held her. and we cried. And she said, "Daddy, I am now ready to receive your love." 16 years later, where could this happen but in Alcoholics Anonymous? So I made amends to everybody. God was helping me without any question about that. One of the beauties of God doing for me what I could not do for myself is that I was a little bit cocky. A little bit. I was telling Peg, "I'm all done with step 9. And she said, "Are you? Got them all?" I said, "Yep." She said, "I got a few names you missed." She always did the steps ahead of me. For me. Anyway, to show you the power of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and a loving God when you abandon yourself to Him. She said, "What about David C?" And I said, "Oh my God, David C." Now, I'm not a badass, and I don't pretend to be one. I never did any stuff that I know of that was illegal. Well, that's not true. We'll pass on that one right now. I never considered myself a badass, but when I was under the influence of alcohol, God knows what will happen. Anyway, David C. is a man that should have been on my list. He wasn't on my list, and I want to tell you that you're never going to get this thing right. You're only going to get it better. Okay, it should have been on the list. So the book says more will be revealed to you. Trust in that. Don't try to write everything down forever. You can spend forever on this. You'll have forever to write this thing, but more will be revealed to you. So as long as you leave nothing out on purpose. Because the God of my understanding said, "Here it is, go get him." David C. is the guy that I loaded up a 38 revolver, and I was going to go blow his goddamn head off. Thank God he was not there. I talked to him on the telephone the next day, and I said, "Look, you son of a bitch, you look over your shoulder for the rest of your life, because if you don't see me first, you're dead." Now, he wasn't on my list, and he should have been on my list. Anyway, Peg would tell me about David C., and we were in a bowling alley. A Cambrian bowl, a plush place. So we went home, and the phone was ringing. And that happened to be my daughter, who lived in Wyoming at the time. No, she lived in Nebraska at that time. My oldest daughter. And my oldest daughter said to me, and she talked a while, and I said, "By the way, honey, so great, glad to hear from you, but do you ever know what happened to David C.?" She said, "Why, Daddy?" And I said, "Well, I have a 9-step to make to him because I owe him something." She said, "Oh, Daddy, I'm so glad. Just a minute, he's standing right beside me." If you trust in God, I found this to be true, and you're totally open and absolute willing, amazing things can happen to you in this life and through the 12 steps of recovery. I believe step 10 is step 4 through 9. Step 10 is 4 through 9. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. You got 10, and that's a combination of what you've done, and you do that for the rest of your life. I have fabulous experience on my 10th step, but I'm running out of time to do that. But I'm saying this, that if you do your 10th step, you can continue to be free. I know freedom that very few people do, because I have died and met my Maker, and I know what freedom is. I've been declared dead, and I've been there, and I know the freedom of knowing, owing nobody anything. And those people whom you love know that you love them, because I've not only demonstrated it, I have told them that I do love them. And I continue with my 11th step and 12th step. And I've run out of time, and the only thing I can say, God, I love you. Thank you so much for instilling in that young man the power to come and get me. You allowed me to learn what love is all about. And I so hope that we all get a chance to share our love together. Thank you very much.